Religious leaders have also denounced the purely provocative move, calling it a direct insult to all Muslims. Officials in Iran have also condemned the French government for supporting the sacrilege of Islam's prophet, peace be upon him, and his progeny, stressing the necessity for Emmanuel Macron to apologize to Muslims. The Iranian Foreign Ministry on Tuesday, October 27th, summoned the French charge d'affaires, Florence Adiolet, over the French president's recent remarks against Islam. The truth is every country has its own rules when it comes to freedom of press and speech. But in general, there are four basic stages at which freedom of the press can be limited. Access to information, prior restraint on publishing inflammatory information, libel and invasion of privacy, and requiring reporters to testify or otherwise disclose sources and materials gathered. The lesson to be learned from this is that nothing is certain or ever will be about the subject. Like any precious and constantly threatened right, its only hope for life rests in unrelenting vigilance of those who understand it best and most appreciate its value, the members of the press themselves. While the recent beheading of a teacher in Paris was a heinous crime, and while expression of any opinion is essential for democracy, very few have ever seen Charlie Hebdo and its level of provocation. In 2008, the bi-weekly tabloid fired a cartoonist who had joked about the Jewish faith. The magazine is a voice defending the superiority of France and its cultural supremacy and has a smile racist leadership, which it obtained by selling provocation, exactly the opposite of the view of a world based on respect and cooperation among different cultures and religions. It is sad to see how the racist publication goes on to publish even more blasphemous cartoons and how a stubborn government continues to prop it up with even bigger political fanfare and with a helping hand from the infamous Macron. At any rate, the recent incidents in France should be seen as a racist deception because the subsequent Islamophobia campaign in the form of anti-terror, raids, and blasphemous cartoons is suspicious and overwhelming. They are never designed to foster interfaith dialogue or understanding between Muslim countries and the West. This is why tensions remain high and will continue to have serious political and cultural reverberations. Angry protests will also continue to take place across the globe, which demonstrate that freedom of speech has its limits when it comes to disrespecting Muslim beliefs and values. Clearly, the French government has once again disregarded Muslim sensitivities and has become a fertile ground for anger and resentment. This is not about a small, tightly networked group of misinformation experts guiding an effort that reaches millions of Westerners through effective advocates, media partners, and grassroots organizing. This is about the fear of the other and its vast right-wing Christian Zionist network that are behind the Islamophobia campaign in Europe and the United States. The spreading of hate and misinformation primarily starts with key people and organizations, which are sustained by funding from a clutch of foundations and racist lobby groups. They solicit money by telling public falsely that they are in imminent danger from Muslims and boast a history of fabricated evidence that perpetuates conspiracies of radical Islam infiltrating Europe through immigration, civil rights, and advocacy organizations. It's the same manifesto that is once again being laid out in France and elsewhere in Europe. What else did you expect from the so-called religious tolerance and freedom of speech and expression in the West?
Inside Israel.
Israel's rapidly escalating coronavirus crisis is aggravating a religious divide there, with ultra-Orthodox leaders accusing mostly secular regime of discrimination and fostering anti-Semitism by focusing on outbreaks in highly observant communities. As the regime struggles to contain the outbreak, ultra-Orthodox Jewish rabbis, cabinet ministers, and parliament members have resisted attempts to curtail activities in ultra-Orthodox areas.
I have to point out, this is not the usual typical Haredi protest that you might see regularly, if I may, because this is not the Mesharim community, the extreme community that is protesting. This is mainstream Haredi people from an affluent, even rich area of Jerusalem, feeling that they were abandoned by the government and by our Haredi Knesset members, feeling that they are discriminated against with this lockdown on them, that we didn't see such lockdowns in Katamon and Rehavia when there was the Gymnasia story. They are feeling that they are treated unfairly, and this is why this anger is going up and up. Nobody is listening to them, and by nobody I'm referring to our Knesset members. These are people who voted for those Knesset members, and they are not getting any answer.
This includes many areas that, according to Israel's secular health ministry, have emerged as COVID-19 hotspots in recent weeks. Clashes like these can be seen across Israel in communities with ultra-Orthodox Jews. They are attacked by what they view as a secular regime that is not fond of their ways. The situation is tense, as many have been injured in clashes and or arrested. This is the second time this year the tensions have come to the surface like this.
Well, Kalev, this neighborhood of Womema is one of the neighborhoods that was declared as a restricted zone on Friday because of the high rate of coronavirus infections. And what you can see here behind me is a large barrier. That's the barrier at the entrance to the neighborhood. And you just saw that it got knocked down because kids were trying to knock down that barrier. And that's actually what happened yesterday. Yesterday, a bunch of protesters gathered in front of these barriers and tried to break through the barriers. And of course, the policemen and the law enforcement that were there had to stop that. And that led to a scuffle between the protesters and the police. And we are expecting something similar to happen here today.
The general ultra-Orthodox Jewish population is not happy about what they perceive as targeting their communities only. A new poll shows that up to 59% of Haredi or ultra-Orthodox Jews distrust the Israeli regime. The Israel Democracy Institute published a recent survey that examines the extent to which the coronavirus pandemic and the policies surrounding it has hindered the ultra-Orthodox community's trust in the Haredi political parties. But the survey backfired and showed that this community, which makes up about 12% of Israel's population, is at odds with the regime and its policies. Over 53.3% of the respondents said that their trust in the health ministry was further harmed. The situation is getting so much out of control that a Haredi minister who is very popular among Israel's ultra-Orthodox Jews just resigned, and more may follow. Housing Minister Yaakov Litzman resigned from cabinet in protest of the regime's imminent decision to impose a general lockdown during the holiday period. The ultra-Orthodox former health minister accuses the regime of failing to act earlier and deliberately picking Rosh Hashanah, that is the Jewish New Year, as the start date of closure. Litzman, the former health minister, had long threatened to resign if the lockdown plan is approved and had also said that his United Torah Judaism party could bolt the coalition. Litzman believes that the secular Israeli regime wanted the lockdowns during the Jewish high holidays because it doesn't want people praying. This while senior ultra-Orthodox rabbi Chaim Kanievsky accused the regime of wanting to keep yeshiva or Jewish religious school scholars from their religious studies, even as secular Israelis are allowed to go to beaches and restaurants.
What is happening very recently is with the coronavirus outbreak, which is a true concern. It's a terrible situation where people are affected and many people have died. And the world is attempting to control the virus. But what is happening is that people who are supposed to officially, according to their claim, they are supposed to represent Judaism, the Jewish religion, and the Jewish people. And it happens to be that they take the other approach, as they did from its very inception, to oppress God's people and oppress the Jewish religion. They go as far as to close synagogues, to close places of worship, close any religious activities whatsoever. And this is just an addition to all opposition that so many people in the world, so many Jewish people in the world, and including in the state of Israel, are so upset with the government. But now it takes a new level where so many people wake up and are outraged. The tension just is escalating. Having people accusing Israel as anti-Semitic and Nazis is nothing new. You can find videos on the internet already for a long time. People describe them as Nazis because many Jewish people feel that the state of Israel has a deep hate towards religious Jewish people, something similar to what other enemies to the Jewish people had in previous generations. Well, the tension between the Israeli government and the Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox people is going back already decades, even before the creation of the State of Israel, since believing Jews really believe that the State of Israel, to begin with, is a rebellion against God. The existence of the state is against God. Jews are in exile. We are forbidden to create a state of our own. All the activities that the Israeli government has perpetrated from the very beginning till the present day against their own people, against the Jewish people, against neighboring people, all of this is in total violation of Judaism. And, you know, each and every time when time passes, there's another season coming up with a new wave of anti-God activities, anti-Jewish activities that the State of Israel is involved in, which upsets righteous people and especially Jewish people who are followers of God and the Jewish religion.
Here's what the online community said about this. Neri says, don't shed tear for Litzman. As the de facto health minister for decades, he let health sector corrode. As health minister during COVID first wave, openly flaunted guidelines and caught virus, undermined Corona Czar's differentiated city plan, and now he's upset it's come to full lockdown. According to Hamat, with up to 40% infected, a Haredi city in Israel becomes coronavirus central. Jonah says Haredi Jews are easily identified and dehumanized because they do not consistently conform to dominant society culture. Juanca says, can they be put in a jail altogether and isolated? The ultra-Orthodox community holds the regime, including Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the newly appointed secular Corona Czar Roni Gamzu, responsible for Ukraine closing its borders for visitors. This has prevented many members of the observant community from traveling to Uman, Ukraine, as part of the annual pilgrimage to the grave of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov on Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year. Ukrainian media reported that locals in the Ukrainian town of Uman had attacked Jewish pilgrims who had already arrived. The ultra-Orthodox community sees the action of the regime and the timing on their most important holiday and pilgrimage as targeting them. The ultra-Orthodox Jewish community is angry over the regime dictates, largely because they see newly appointed Corona Czar as a secular Israeli who would like the religious to disappear. In the eyes of many Haredim, these rules are applied selectively against them. They are a put-up job, they believe. The ultra-Orthodox Jews believe that life should be ruled by the Torah and not by the consensus of the regime.
Yes, the authorities in Israel have basically attacked our communities from its very beginning. This is happening each and every time again. It just repeats itself every so often. This is ongoing, this is continuing, and therefore our youth grow up with this deep opposition to this Israeli government, feeling ourselves oppressed and finding the state of Israel as the greatest danger presently to Jewish people. In the main difference we have to remember is that the Jewish people are a people of religion, a people of God. This is all what makes us Jewish, and this is what we practice. Judaism is all about religion, all about the practice of religion. This movement of Zionism, the philosophy of Zionism, and later the state of Israel, is a total rebellion against God and the Jewish religion. We have to remember this difference, and this difference is just growing and growing and growing, because the state of Israel is going in that angle, in that direction, going further away from God and his religion, and then religious ultra-Orthodox Jews are just going towards the Jewish religion, and this ends up to be a very great conflict and difference. Well, this is happening already for decades, where the Israeli police is harassing our communities, and this happens time and again. What's happening recently now is regarding the coronavirus, and what our communities are demanding is that our religious needs should be at least as essential as allowing people to go to the beach, go to the restaurants, or travel on public transportation. The government does not ban any transportation. They don't require to have an individual vehicle for every individual person, because they do understand they are essential needs. Our religious obligations, our religious needs should be respected at least as any other needs to other people. Regulations should be in place, control of the virus should be in place, and every individual should comply with. And I have to be very clear that our issue with the philosophy of Zionism and our opposition to the state of Israel is not just because they oppress us. It's not just because they don't actually practice our religion. It goes way deeper than that. Even if the leaders of the state of Israel will be religious, the concept of fighting other nations, the concept of ending the divinely decreed exile by physical means is totally forbidden, and we do not accept that.
Social media users are still divided over the issue. Alan says, I would say this. The reason for the high rate of coronavirus among Haredim has to do with the fact that the members of this community live in close quarters. As a result, the disease spread like a fire through dry timber. Also, some of the exposure came on Jewish holidays too. Saggy says, there's nothing to apologize for. You do not apologize for parties in Tel Aviv, where there is no infection. And on the other hand, the ultra-Orthodox are still almost half of all those infected in Israel, if not more. Dr. G.A. replies, mistake? This is not a mistake. This is another part of your campaign against everything that is Jewish or national.
People are desperate. People don't have work. Old people, Holocaust survivors, they have no money. They have no education. Children need to be educated. There's no program. People feel they don't have a future.
To uproot Judaism from the religion, to change it into nationalism, the ideology of having a state is totally forbidden for us. And therefore, we are always in a constant state of conflict with Zionism. And this happens all the time, and this is ongoing. And now, Zionists have jumped on the opportunity under the pretext of COVID-19 protection for us. They try to limit our religious activity. And what we say is that our religious activity is equally important, just like other communities are allowed to go on with their life, and we do the same in the same manner. We do take measures to protect our communities, not to spread the virus. We keep the social distancing and other measures in place, but in the same manner that other communities are allowed to practice their type of life, we are not allowed. And that is total discrimination. And this is now the issue that's going on between us and the Israeli regime.
Ultra-Orthodox Jews have been attacked in ultra-Orthodox neighborhoods. This is the latest outbreak of violence between the community and armed forces. Dozens of people were arrested across Israel, and scores of people were injured, including armed forces. The ultra-Orthodox community is retaliating against police. As police attempted to violently convince worshippers, hundreds of locals, including children, surrounded the police vehicles. The group blocked the cops by sitting down in the road and hurled rocks and other objects at the officers, including bottles, dirty diapers, and fireworks. This is not the first time that the ultra-Orthodox communities have been targeted in the lockdowns. In fact, earlier this year in April, they were also the targets of such crackdowns. That caused international outcry by Jews across the world and by Western governments. Israeli special forces were seen with weapons in ultra-Orthodox neighborhoods, while the members of the community were calling them Nazis and spitting at them. Here is the news making the press in Israel. Ynet News. A police officer was seen flinging a bucket at a 13-year-old ultra-Orthodox Jewish boy before arresting him during protests by the observant ultra-Orthodox community against what they call secular regime elements. In another event at the scene, a police officer was seen pushing a man while holding a baby. The cameraman can be heard in the footage shouting at police, "He's with a child! He's with a child!" The Jerusalem Post. The combined pressures of working from home while also parenting children, who are at times very young, is decreasing productivity and increasing stress, experts warn. With schools closed due to the coronavirus pandemic, parents have been forced to function as instant teachers, mind their children, and, if they were lucky enough to keep their jobs during the unemployment surge, to keep working from home. I-24 News. The Israeli economy is facing more trouble. Now, the head of Israel's central bank, Professor Amir Yaron, called on the regime to immediately allow small businesses to reopen as fears of a deepening economic crisis continues to grow. One of the biggest problems for Israel is the fact that the budget for 2021 has not yet been approved, adding unnecessary uncertainty in the face of the crisis, he said. The Times of Israel, an alliance of small business owners, has warned they will defy a coronavirus lockdown and open, saying they can no longer stomach the financial cost of the regime's limitations. The lockdown has drastically curbed public life, shuttered the education system, along with many businesses, and banned the right to protest.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. website is www.parstoday.com/en. Amir Kabir. Khayyam. Maulana. Avicenna. Khwarizmi. Iranian notables, sources of global honor.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and welcome to the program. In this episode, you'll get familiar with another Iranian poet who lived in 7th and 8th centuries AH, corresponding to 13th and 14th centuries AD. He was Seyf Faraghani. Seyf Faraghani has been known as a leader of socio-political poetry in Farsi language. The 7th and 8th centuries AH were among the bright eras of Iran's literary history, as masters of poetry and Gnosticism like Maulana, Saadi, and Hafiz lived in that era. There is little known about the life and times of Saifuddin Abul Mohammed Muhammad Faraghani. Dr. Zabihullah Safa, who has edited his Divan or collection of poems, writes in the introduction, "Our whole information about him is restricted to the Divan of poems that has remained for us, as there is name or trace mentioned in the literary references and sources of this able poet. Although he had a high status in expression of mystic concepts and certainly has been one of the leaders of Khanqa, there is no trace of him in the Farsi books of the great figures of mysticism and Gnosticism." Dr. Safa laments, "Saifuddin Faraghani is among the professional orators whose fellow Farsi speakers managed to get acquainted with him some 7 centuries after his death. Till then, no name had been mentioned from him. For the first time, Professor Ahmad Atash from the University of Istanbul mentioned the name of Seyf Faraghani. This caused late Mojtaba Minavi to provide an edition of his Divan." Dr. Zabihullah Safa continues, "The main cause of his being anonymous in the history of Farsi literature and among those who have authored the life of the Iranian poets, scholars, and mystics is that Seyf Faraghani hadn't returned home after migration to Rome. He died in the era when Asia Minor was under the Ilkhanid rule and the Mongol plunder had caused poverty, distress, and chaos. Thus, this region had a weak relation with Iran. Moreover, Seyf Faraghani lived and passed away in a small town called Aksari, which didn't become famous later on." Thank you. Saif Farahani was born in Farghane in Transoxiana in today's Central Asia and Afghanistan. The region is in the east of the old Sogdiana and surrounded by Hisar and Zarafshan Mountains. It is not known when he left the region for the west. It is only known that he had stayed in Tabriz for a while, so it is likely that he had left Farghane as a young man. According to his poems, Dr. Zafa says, his birth had taken place during the developments of the Mongol onslaughts and at most in the first half of the 7th century AH. The last date that he has mentioned in his poems indicates that he had been alive. It is 705 AH. Muhammad bin Ali, an author from Aksaray, in a book that he wrote in 749, names Saif Farahani among the dead. Accordingly, it can be said that Saif lived for long and passed away at the age of 80 or 90. During his stay in Tabriz, Humam Tabrizi had communications with him and learned much from him. There is no doubt that Saif Farahani was an ascetic Sufi, but it is not clear who was his teacher and master in the field. He has some poems in praise of the infallible progeny and imams of the Prophet of Islam. Yet, Dr. Safa maintains that he was a Hanafi Sunni Muslim. He has eulogized Imam Ali and also has poems on the injustices imposed on Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, and his family, relatives, and companions. The Diwan of Poetry of Saif Farahani consists of uds, lyrics, quatrains, and comprises of 11,000 lines. It seems that he had no other work besides this Diwan. A quick look at his poetry shows that he was a skilled poet. He was among the few poets who combined art with mysticism and religious beliefs. His arts are about monotheism, panegyrics of the Prophet of Islam, didactics and criticism of turbulent circumstances and different social classes. He never employed lofty arts for praising kings and courtiers. He has just composed a few lines in praise of Azan Khan. Even in those poems, he either admonishes or mentions the miseries caused by the Ilkhani rulers for the beleaguered people of Eastern Roman Empire. Saif Farahani has dedicated part of his arts to sort of conversation and exchanging of views with renowned poets of his era. This was a habit since the waning years of the 6th century AH. In other words, an erudite poet was the one who could respond to his masters. Dear listeners, next time we will get familiar with another Iranian notable. God bless.
Around the World with Reporters.
Sans doute plus dur.
In reaction to the stance of French President Emmanuel Macron in defense of the offensive caricatures of Prophet Muhammad, the Iranian daily Vatan Emruz published a cartoon of Emmanuel Macron represented as a demon, accompanied by the title The Devil of Paris. This cartoon came after a wave of angry protests and reactions swept across the Muslim world after the French president defended the Charlie Hebdo publication of the insulting Prophet Muhammad cartoon, declaring that France will not give up cartoons. The Macron remarks have triggered anti-French sentiments in the Muslim world, prompting calls for the boycott of French goods and an official apology.
I believe the republication of the offensive Prophet Muhammad cartoons is aimed at testing the unity of Muslims in the face of any sacrilegious act against their sanctities. The second point I think the French government is after is to make such insulting cartoons look normal and to promote hatred and Islamophobia in the world.
The publication of the cartoon of Prophet Muhammad outraged Muslims worldwide, but I believe the support of the French president for such offensive cartoons was much more insulting and indeed added fuel to the fire of Muslims' anger.
Daily Kayhan demanded that the French ambassador be expelled from Iran, believing that it would be the least thing to be done in response to Macron's insolence.
The publication of Prophet Muhammad cartoon shows that the freedom of expression is just a pretext in the hands of the French government and its allies to spread Islamophobia across the world.
Meanwhile, leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei in a letter has urged the French youth to question the so-called reason underpinning French President Emmanuel Macron's support for insult against the Prophet of Islam, peace be upon him, in the name of freedom of speech. After the message of the leader to the French youth, the French Instagram account of the leader's website was blocked. The move is viewed by experts as a double standard policy of the West towards the so-called freedom of expression. At the same time, Iran's president Hassan Rouhani has said any affront directed at the Prophet of Islam is in fact an insult to human values, morality and freedom. President Rouhani has said that supporting those who insult the Prophet of Islam amounts to supporting vice, desecration and extremism. Also in a statement, 240 Iranian lawmakers lashed out at the French government for the move. Moreover, Iranians from all walks of life took part in a protest rally in front of the French embassy in Tehran to protest against the French magazine Charlie Hebdo and the publication of an image of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him.
Iranians believe that fueling Islamophobia and hatred in the name of freedom of expression, which should serve understanding, empathy, and peaceful coexistence between human societies, is regrettable. Salman Khujuri, Tehran.
These fighter jets are aligned in one of Iran's major air bases, dubbed Shahid Babai, located in Isfahan province. Their mission is to fly some 250 kilometers away to hit their simulated enemy targets. This is part of the last phase of a large-scale maneuver held by the Iranian Army's Air Force. During the two-day drill, Air Force personnel practiced air-to-air shooting, air-to-surface bombardment using smart bombs and rockets, and radar and thermal missiles. Military officials here say the drill was a success.
We conduct such drills to bolster our defense might. We need to be strong to deter any prospect of war on the part of our enemies. And what we learned through this maneuver is that we have it in ourselves to nip any threat in the bud.
Iran's Air Force, among other units of the country's military sector, have been under 4 decades of U.S.-led sanctions. This has led the Islamic Republic to rely on its own expertise to build up its defense arsenal. Last month, the United Nations Security Council terminated its arms embargo against Tehran amid a strong opposition from the U.S. Iran emphasizes that with or without the armed bans, the country is capable of defending its security.
The U.S. thought wrongly that its so-called maximum pressure against Iran would bring us to our knees. We proved during the sanctions that any pressure imposed by the United States is doomed to failure. Today, the lifting of the UN arms bans definitely gives us an edge. But more importantly, it isolated Washington on the international stage.
Iran's army says today the Islamic Republic produces over 80% of its defense equipment domestically. This, as Tehran underlines, that its military might is based on the doctrine of defense, and that the country will never be the first to pull the trigger.
The Iranian army's air force says it owes its might to decades of arms embargoes led by the U.S., which sought to undermine Iran's security. But in fact, it forced the country to stand on its own feet and indigenize its defense sector. And now that the arms bans are lifted, military officials here say this will definitely give the Islamic Republic an extra boost in its defense agenda. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drills.
Starting on Tuesday, November 3rd, There will be a second lockdown in Austria to contain a massive second wave of COVID-19 infections across Europe. All events will be cancelled. Hotels, restaurants and bars will close, and a curfew will be in place between 8 p.m. and 6 a.m. Universities and classes for older students will switch to distance learning. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz told The Nation, "We will have to do without a lot of what makes up our lives."
If the number of new infections continues to grow so rapidly, Austria's healthcare system, although it's one of the best in the world, will soon be out of capacity.
The country's health minister says Austria is in a race against time.
The turnaround must be achieved by mid-November, otherwise doctors will have to choose who to treat via triage. If we act now, we can gradually begin reopening at the beginning of December.
Health authorities are worried about the repercussions of an explosion of infections in October. On Saturday, more than 5,300 new infections were reported across the country, five times more than just 2 weeks ago. As a tourist and sport nation, Austria is affected particularly hard by the restrictions. The government has announced that affected businesses will get 80% of their revenue from the same month last year reimbursed if they keep all their employees on the payroll. Anyone not following the new rules could face fines reaching up to 1,500 euros.
The question that everyone wants an answer for is when all this will end. The definitive end of all measures will only be possible when there's an effective vaccine, experts say. Austria's Chancellor told the people he's confident they can have a normal summer again in 2021. Homa Leski, Vienna.
The United States' separating of Iran from the global financial system has hindered the Islamic Republic's ability to secure supplies of food and drugs as it struggles to rein in a resurgence of the coronavirus outbreak. The U.S. Treasury has time and again claimed that these items are exempted from the sanctions on the Islamic Republic. To delve into the issue, we talked to some MPs to see how Washington's targeting of over a dozen of banks has paralyzed import of drugs.
This is not true. Food and drugs have not been accepted from sanctions. In cases, the Islamic Republic has faced very cruel sanctions in its food and medicine sector. The United States has imposed unlawful sanctions on medical needs of those suffering from rare diseases. They are limiting Iran's access to raw materials to stir up anger among people.
One of the fields in which they are putting pressure on the Iranian nation is the pharmaceutical sector. Medicines are not used in military or nuclear sphere. The sick people need the drugs, but Washington has restricted the import of tablets and injection shots. This reveals their enmity with the Iranian people. I think our people are paying the price of standing on their own feet.
Drug and medical supply companies in Iran are now saying that the new sanctions have affected their work. Iran makes many of its needed drugs inside the country through pharmaceutical research, but treatments for cancer or rare diseases and transplants often rely on imports.
We must expand our knowledge. We must be aware that Iran will always be under sanctions by the Zionists and the U.S. Day by day, these sanctions will be expanded, so we need to have the knowledge to meet our needs by producing medicines domestically.
Iranians' access to medicine and their right to health is being threatened and may worsen if the situation does not change.
After sanctioning 18 Iranian banks as part of its maximum pressure policy, in its latest move, the U.S. government sanctioned Iran's oil minister, oil industry, and related companies. Human Abedi, Tehran.
Afghans are marking the arrival of the birthday anniversary of the Prophet Muhammad under the name of Unity Week, at a time when Islamophobia is growing in some parts of the world and amid French President Emmanuel Macron's recent insulting comments about the Holy Prophet of Islam, people in Afghanistan are attending ceremonies like this one in Kabul as a show of respect and love for the Prophet of over 2 billion Muslims.
I'm here to show my strong support and deep love for the beloved Holy Prophet. Fortunately, we can attend different ceremonies that deepen our understanding of Islam.
We don't care about insulting words of individuals like Macron. This is especially because our leader, the Holy Prophet, has ordered us to be logically patient. Instead, we mark Unity Week to show how the followers of Islam's Holy Prophet ignore tensions and approve unity.
Based on Islamic beliefs, the arrival of Unity Week, as its title suggests, serves as a big opportunity for Muslims to once again return to the main teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, such as strengthening unity among Muslims. Some others believe that the arrival of the birthday anniversary of Islam's Holy Prophet is also an opportunity for mankind to review the life and words of the Prophet Muhammad to see the real face of Islam.
Unity Week, in fact, brings unity among nations and Islamic societies like Afghanistan. I'm proudly saying it that Afghanistan is one of the leading countries of the Muslim world when it comes to the issue of Islamic brotherhood.
I call on your audience to please study the true life and words of Islam's Holy Prophet. Yes, this is too important for anybody who is seeking truth about Islam and its honorable and holy leader, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him.
Besides calling for boosting Islamic brotherhood among Afghans, those attending ceremonies marking Unity Week say the cementing of national unity among Afghans is one of the musts associated with Unity Week, as observers say the best way to lead the nation to a real national unity is to remove the obstacles in the way of the ongoing peace talks between the government and Taliban in the Qatari capital Doha. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
A shutdown is being observed in Indian-controlled Kashmir after New Delhi amended and repealed a series of decades-old land laws of Kashmir. The new reorganization law issued on October 26, 2020, opens up all of Jammu and Kashmir to every Indian citizen and removes every restriction that prevented large land holdings. Allows the Indian Armed Forces to take over land wherever they desire and gives sweeping powers to the government to take over any land and property for industrial use and bring in big businesses to set up their shops. People's Democratic Party President Mehbooba Mufti, while criticizing the government's move, accused India of land grab for big investors. The October 26, 2020 order repealed 13 state laws and amends 14 laws. Experts say this is to further the agenda behind the abrogation. According to historic date check, these laws were introduced to empower the majority Muslims who were suffering immensely under the non-Muslim rulers. Not only this, but the rights to buy and sell land in Kashmir were also confined to the people of Kashmir. Experts say India's move in Kashmir since August 5, 2019 has further internationalized this conflict. In response to the shutdown call by pro-freedom camp of Kashmir, shops and businesses remained closed. Huge number of government forces were seen guarding the streets to avoid law and order problems. Almost seven decades ago, these laws were introduced to empower the Muslim majority of Kashmir. But today, when the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party is repealing and amending the same laws, the people of Kashmir are watching over helplessly. Experts say this move clearly depicts India's intentions in Kashmir. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
The U.S. economy just recorded its largest quarter of economic growth ever, 33%. Too bad it comes on the heels of a 31% plunge in the last economic quarter. The seven-month-long failure to pass a second stimulus package pushed stocks to their worst week in 7 months. The U.S. appears to have been taken by surprise by the long-expected autumn wave of coronavirus, with new lockdowns creating major anger among the businesses who weren't bankrupted by the spring lockdowns.
The small manufacturing businesses, even small service businesses, we need to assume their expenses so that when we're on the other side of the pandemic, they're still viable. There isn't a will to do that, and I think that's because the government's really controlled by the major corporations and major banks, and they don't want it.
Pro-Trump media coverage is dominated by the ever-ballooning allegations of major financial corruption by the Biden family. Joe Biden has never disputed the authenticity of the proof which alleges corruption, but he has denied the allegations of corruption. Anti-Trump media is focused on widespread fears of post-election violence.
I tend to think we're going to get through the election okay, you know? But there are enough crazy people out there, and it's been promoted. That type of hatred has been promoted, by Trump. It's been promoted by television stations.
Right-wing media says the polls show that Donald Trump might lose the general election but will handily win the Electoral College vote. Their claim is based around the so-called shy voter theory that Trump supporters aren't talking honestly to polling agencies. Centrist media says the majority of polls maintain a small but narrowing lead for the challenger Joe Biden. They say Biden will win handily when the record number of mail-in ballots are totally counted, which could take many weeks. Add all that up and throw in a few more vital issues which we don't have the space to list, and it's clear that America is heading into a historic election in a hugely chaotic state marked by fear, uncertainty, and hysteria. The vote is on Tuesday, November 3rd. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
More protests were held in the Italian capital on Saturday over the government's decision to impose tougher measures to contain the spread of the pandemic. Early in the afternoon, hundreds of far-right demonstrators staged a rally in Campo di Fiori against a new decree which has ordered the closure of gyms, cinemas and theatres, requiring cafes and restaurants to close their doors at 6 p.m. Clashes with police were recorded during the demonstration. Later on Saturday, another protest was held in Independence Square, not far from Rome's central train station, where thousands of protesters vented their anger at the latest anti-COVID-19 restrictions. This demonstration, dubbed You Close Us, You Pay, was called by a coalition of social movements and base unions.
Unfortunately, the government has done nothing to reduce the flow of travelers on local public transports, which have been turned into hotbeds of COVID-19 transmission. Furthermore, too many workers have not received any payroll subsidies from the government yet. How can they pay their bills and mortgage installments?
The government cannot close cafes and restaurants at 6 p.m. Owners can scrape by, maybe. But what about us workers? These restrictions are killing us.
From north to south, Italy's been hit by a wave of protests, some violent, following the introduction of more stringent coronavirus shutdown measures by the government. The country's interior ministry has warned that these demonstrations have been infiltrated by subversives who are trying to stir up trouble.
As the contagion curve continues to rise in Italy, Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte insists he doesn't want to enforce another lockdown, but many fear a new national quarantine is becoming inevitable.
So many people have already closed their activity after the first lockdown. Some manage to survive, but they won't survive a second lockdown.
The government is expected to present a decree including new restrictions as early as Monday. Targeted lockdowns and restrictions of movement between regions are among the new measures reportedly being discussed. Max Civili, Rome.
Violent clashes in Pakistan in capital Islamabad. Police use heavy shelling to prevent thousands of angry protesters to march towards the French embassy in the capital. Protesters reached near the red zone after they forcibly removed heavy security barriers one after the other on the road leading towards the diplomatic enclave. At the heart of public anger is frequent incidents of blasphemy committed against the Prophet of Islam. Many protesters were injured in the violent clashes with the police. Over a dozen were also arrested.
This is just tip of the iceberg of a public anger against France. Protesters are saying that they are not going to settle down anything short of shutting down French embassy and expelling French ambassador from Islamabad.
French newspapers have repeatedly published blasphemous cartoons under the cover of freedom of speech. However, for Muslims in Pakistan and elsewhere, it was a politically motivated attempt to insult Islam, which, according to a Pew survey, is spreading.